This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The state of Ohio is moving steadily to the right. Its draconian abortion ban has no exceptions for rape or incest, which would have been nearly unthinkable until very recently. Last month, Ohio's ban forced a 10-year-old victim of rape to travel out of the state to end that pregnancy. So how did Ohio, formerly a swing state that voted for President Obama twice, shift so decisively to the right? That's the subject of a report in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer, a longtime staff writer. Jane, you've been a political reporter for a while, based in Washington. What drew you to this deep dive into Ohio politics?
Well, Ohio's been seen forever as the bellwether state in America. So what happens there is very important in determining presidential elections and also in kind of giving us a temperature on what's happening in the country.
Now, a lot of change seems to be happening there. We thought of it always as a swing state for the longest time, and now it's solidly in Republican control. To what extent are voters changing their opinions ideologically? And to what extent is this due to other factors like redistricting?
Well, this was what was so interesting to me, was that the state has a reputation for having relatively moderate, slightly conservative voters. It's not an extreme state. It was a state that went for Obama twice and then went for Trump twice. What's interesting is it's legislating out of its state legislature in a way that a study found was more conservative than South Carolina. So the government seems to be out of kilter with the population.
What are the numbers of voters supporting each party? How does it cut? And how skewed is the representation?
The numbers vary, but it's roughly divided, slightly more Republican than Democratic. I think it's 54% Republican to 46% Democratic on average over the last 10 years.
Now, for your piece, you talk with a fascinating figure in Ohio politics, a political analyst and a politician named David Pepper. Who is he?
So David Pepper turns out to have been, he was the former Democratic chairman of Ohio, of the party there. He was a former city councilman in Cincinnati. He is a man obsessed with one issue.
What is that?
Gerrymandering.
Now, gerrymandering happens everywhere, and it happens on both sides, by the way.
It does.
Why is this such a big deal in Ohio?
Well, what's happened is it's kind of changed the whole direction of the state while nobody's been paying any attention. The thing about, and David Pepper is the first to admit this, the thing about state politics, state house politics and things like gerrymandering is they're eye-glazingly dull. This is, it's processes that, you know, only the most, avid can follow or even want to follow. Nobody even knows the name of the people who's their own state representative. So he's one of those people who has been paying attention. And what he's seeing is something that he considers a complete meltdown of democracy. And that is the way the state was gerrymandered very purposefully has changed the whole course of history there.
Jane, David Pepper wrote a book called Laboratories of Autocracy. Tell me about that.
So in his desperation to try to get attention to this issue of gerrymandering, David Pepper wrote this book about what's happened to Ohio because of the gerrymandering, and he calls it Laboratories of Autocracy. The subtitle is A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. And, you know, it's his flair from behind the lines to try to get people to pay attention to Ohio. It's a takeoff on a very famous statement from Louis Brandeis, the former Supreme Court justice, who said that state houses are laboratories of democracy.
So then let's hear some of your conversation with the author David Pepper.
So, David, how did you first come across all of this? It'd be interesting to hear a little bit about your background here.
So I'm from Cincinnati. I've moved back to Cincinnati after law school. I clerked for a wonderful federal Sixth Circuit judge. This was around 2000 when Cincinnati went through a very tough time with a number of police shootings, riots, a boycott. And the city that I grew up being so proud of was performing terribly. So I'm saying all this to say that's when I ran for office myself. I ran for city council. And it was a different time where you ran because you thought it was public service. And that was my first entry to politics. I won. I had a good, successful year. Then I ultimately became a county commissioner. And then I ran statewide. And I ran for state auditor in 2010, which is one of the positions that if I had won, we could have ended gerrymandering. And that is when I first began to really explore gerrymandering, how bad it was. But the thing I learned in that race was that no one knew anything about what I was talking about. Here's a system that determines your entire democracy as a state, and nobody had a clue what the auditor was or how the auditor impacted anything, let alone the drawing of our democracy. And ever since, I became really obsessed with this horrible practice that you basically have politicians that are drawing districts that essentially, you know, subvert democracy.
Well, 2010 was a big year, wasn't it, for gerrymandering?
Yeah, it was a big year in our history. For the rest of our lives, I think 2010 is shaping so much of what's come since. We let our guard down. You know, Democrats love to focus on a few federal races, the presidency, some swing states, some swing districts to get ourselves federal majorities, because in our mind, that's what elections and politics are about. But if you understand that state houses shape democracy, which the other side has understood, that means that 2010 was a very important year. Basically, if you look over the last 10 years, almost every single district that was drawn, the results are exactly as they drew them then. So yeah, we have elections, just like, you know, other countries around the world have elections. But we're at a point now in Ohio where, at least at the legislative level, the elections are predetermined. The outcomes are generally blowouts. So it's a process of democracy that feels democratic, but the outcomes are basically preordained in almost every one of these seats.
Jane, let's pause on that for a moment. What actually happened in 2010?
So 2010 was a year of Republican backlash against Obama, and Pepper thinks that what happened was that after the 2008 election of Obama, the Republican Party panicked, basically. They lost control of Washington. Obama swept Congress and the White House, and the only opening left for Republicans were the state houses, and they just went for them.
What does that mean, went for them?
Well, the state houses were, first of all, it's a pretty easy and cheap investment for Republican donors to make. And so what happened was big donors in the Republican Party were directed to pour $30 million into an organization that the Republican Party created called Red Map, which was basically, as it sounds, an effort to turn the entire map in the country red at the state house level. And they poured money into these legislative districts. And by the end of the 2010 election, the Republican Party picked up something like 700 seats.
And I think Ohio was one of those states where they won big. Let's get back to the interview.
So currently, the Republican members in the state house have an advantage of 64 to 35. And in the state Senate, 25 to 8. How's this playing out in practical terms in Ohio? What kinds of bills are you seeing that they're passing?
Yeah. once you have a rigged, gerrymandered legislature, they don't behave like the people of Ohio. They behave as extreme as the most extreme legislature going. And the laws are just like the ones in Florida or Alabama. They're all the same because many of them are being written and then shared with all of them at the same time. And every time one passes somewhere, like that don't say gay law in Florida, it comes to Ohio because they showed they could do it there. It came here, they do it here.
What is happening with gun laws in Ohio at this point? Where is the state on gun restrictions? You've had, I think, a terrible shooting not that long ago in Dayton.
Yeah. Same thing. We're legislating like we're the most far-right state in the country. This is very similar on every issue. Most Ohioans support common-sense gun reforms. It's not even close. We're talking about strong majorities. And in Ohio, they're legislating as if it's the opposite. Mike DeWine, the governor, this guy had an F rating with the NRA when he was a U.S. senator. He has now signed several bills, you know, an extreme form of stand your ground, one permitless carry in the last couple months. But in states like Ohio, you see this pattern where the unaccountable legislature is the one that drives the political machine. Once that state house is in a position where it can't be held accountable, it puts people who actually do face elections in an impossible position. And I know you focus a lot on courts. Think about it this way. State houses are the sword in the attack on democracy. Courts are the shield. Courts are the reason that Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society works so hard on the federal courts is so those courts can uphold the extremist laws coming out of state houses. But no one should ever lose sight of the fact, and we have for far too long, that their front line on the attack on democracy are rigged, gerrymandered state houses. That's where almost all of it takes place.
Well, let's talk for a second about the case, the plight of this 10-year-old girl from Ohio who was the victim of a rape, apparently when she was 9 years old, became pregnant, and had to flee to Indiana to get an abortion because of the new restrictions in Ohio. Is this, as you see it, a direct result of gerrymandering? And secondly, is there a chance that maybe the reaction, the backlash to it, will be big enough in Ohio that it may begin to wake people up and change this situation?
Yeah, it's certainly a direct result. I mean, we are being governed by extremists who do not reflect Ohio. That's just clear. One of the most important things to appreciate about gerrymandering, again, it's not just leading to Republicans being in charge when they don't reflect a majority, which is what happens in some states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. The way they gerrymander is to not have any swing seats. So the old moderate Republican who would have said, I'm not voting for that bill with no exceptions. I would lose my office. I'm in a swing district. They've gotten rid of those people. So the gerrymandering basically has empowered the most extreme people, you know, the Gene Schmitz and others who literally said that a rape was an opportunity for a young woman to bring a baby into the world. That's who's writing the laws. And again, in a system where a moderate gerrymander, you'd have some moderate saying, Gene Schmidt, I can't vote for that. Those people are gone because those districts are gone. And that's why you see the outcomes that are the direct result of these laws. There's no incentive to be moderate. The only incentive that is rewarded is being extreme. So every time one of them brings up a more extreme law, even some who might be queasy about that cannot vote no. They would lose, and they know it. So yeah, it's a direct result, and it will continue.
You know, the story of the 10-year-old rape victim went viral.
And here's this really sad news. That's one case of many, many, many cases that are going to play out for months and years. And so I think Republicans think like around gun violence, oh, it's going to go away. They'll move on to something else. This isn't going to go away. It's going to keep happening.
I mean, it seems pretty clear that Ohio voters, they want to reform these districts and try to restore democracy and get rid of the extreme partisan gerrymandering. They've tried twice to reform it, right? And what's happened?
Yeah. The voters voted 70% plus two times to end the rigging of first it was the state house and then it was Congress. And they did it in 15 and 18. Overwhelming. And what the Republican legislature did is they basically said in 21, we're not going to do it. We are simply not going to do it. And in Columbus, the talk was they were running out the clock because we have a Ohio Supreme Court that is in the balance in this November's election. So what does run out the clock mean in real terms? They simply ignored the Constitution. They did many things the Constitution said they were not allowed to do. And every time the Supreme Court of Ohio, in a bipartisan way with a Republican Chief Justice, ruled, you guys are violating the language that 70% of Ohioans put into place, they simply ignored the ruling. They have succeeded. I'm going to say this. It sounds dramatic, but it's true. They have succeeded in forcing Ohioans to live for the next 2 years in maps for both the State House and Congress that are unconstitutional.
Jane, the Ohio courts rejected these heavily gerrymandered maps, and the state legislature just ignored the court and used them anyway. How is that possible? Isn't that a constitutional crisis on some level?
It is a constitutional crisis. I mean, it's an incredible story about what's happening in Ohio, which was the Republicans had the majority and were in charge of the operation of redistricting. And instead of going along with the will of the state, they came up with five maps in a row that their own Supreme Court in Ohio said violate the law.
Now, it's often said that gerrymandering leads to extremism for the party in power. Why is that? Why can't moderates win?
So I asked the same question because it seems like if you would go too far, it would be popular to have a moderate come in and challenge the extremist, especially if the voting population's not that extreme. But what happens is in primaries, it's only the most partisan and hardcore who turn out. And so it as an experiment, what we're learning is there's almost no extreme that's too extreme. Once you've got districts where the other party can't challenge you, the only pressure is to keep going further and further right in the Republican Party.
What are other examples of that? You mentioned abortion. What other issues has this led to a big rightward swing in Ohio?
Well, on guns is one of the really big issues. So overall, if you take a look at polls in the state, 61% of Ohio's population wants new and more restrictions on gun rights. And what did they get? So few that even the largest police organization in the state has been testifying against these gun laws as being dangerous. What have they got? They've got one law that enables teachers to be armed with less than 24 hours of training, not just teachers, but others who work in schools, cafeteria workers, bus drivers, janitors. They've got a stand your ground law, and they've also got now a permitless concealed carry law, which means that anybody who wants a handgun without any kind of permit or background check can get a handgun and carry it concealed. And if the police pull you over, like in your car, and you've got a gun in there, you have no obligation to let the police know that you're armed. The police are, you know, think it's just endangering them.
Let's get back to the interview with David Pepper.
In Washington, there are an awful lot of people who, including sometimes President Biden, who have talked about Trump as basically the originator of the attacks on democracy and the central problem with politics today, Trump and the threat that he may run again. You don't see it that way. Why?
No. I think it's an enormous mistake when we lump it all together as sort of never Trump or Trump this, or even when we talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'll be very blunt. I mean, it's been our entire history, but the most recent iteration of the attack on democracy, as we just described, began ever before Trump decided to run for office. If Trump were locked up to tomorrow for January 6th, they would still attack democracy. And the mistake that we make when we make it about Trump is we make it far too narrow. We're all about personalities, so we think about Trump and not institutions. But if you lined up the set of things that are happening right now and said to an average American, this is all happening in country X, what do you think? They'd say they're losing their democracy. And then you all of a sudden reveal, well, it's actually Ohio and all these other states. That's the reality.
Now, I know you are the former chairman of the Democratic Party in Ohio, but I assume that the Democrats weren't angels when it came to gerrymandering themselves back when they had power. So what's the difference?
Democrats in other states gerrymander as well. I'm very clear on this. So this is not a both sides issue. The Republican form of it is right now far more extreme and lurching in ways that you don't see in Democratic states. And the other thing I'll give credit, a lot of the Democratic states are the states that have led reforms like Michigan and other places that have actually put into place independent commissions. So people who care about this should study what Michigan did. They have an independent commission that drew the maps. It worked reasonably well, and they got out of this business of rigging all elections.
We often hear that democracy is under attack and that it's dying. Given everything that we've been talking about, is democracy already dead in Ohio?
It's on life support. I mean, you can't watch at the state legislative level. It's on life support or worse. It is very much like a country somewhere else that essentially the people have no choice. But it doesn't mean you can't claw it back. We need help from the federal level, and the U.S. Senate and House and Biden need to pass federal protections that in the last 2 years they have failed to pass, which I think is a tragedy. Until we do that, democracy will be dead.
Now, I can hear lots of voices out there saying, wait a minute, gerrymandering is something that both parties do. Barack Obama, when he was a young politician, was the beneficiary of a gerrymandered district. His district got reconfigured when he was in Illinois state politics. So why is there a bad guy here?
I mean, and you are right. And we quote someone who's a Republican official in the story saying gerrymandering, you know, goes back to the early days of the Republic. And before the Republicans did it in Ohio, the Democrats who were in charge did it in Ohio. What's happened is it's become much more of a dark art. Thanks to computers and digital, mapping, they have figured out ways now to do it that are so extreme that you can create districts, as they have in Ohio, where whoever holds that district can't be knocked out by someone from the other party. They've just really dissected the state in a way that's beyond competition.
What you're saying is that the Republican Party was just better at the gerrymandering drama than the Democratic Party.
Much better at it, and so good at it that it's become a science experiment, a political science experiment. And so what we're seeing is what happens in a democracy when you can no longer compete against the other party.
Jane, is there any sort of federal action that could rein in some of these excesses at the state level?
Well, no. In fact, the federal courts did weigh in Ohio, and they supported the extreme gerrymandering and basically overrode the state Supreme Court and said, go ahead and have the election anyway with these districts that the state Supreme Court says are unconstitutional.
And the Democrats themselves are powerless to do anything in Republican-led states?
Well, the best thing they can do right now in Ohio is they're trying to re-elect a Supreme Court that will be activist and try to strike these districts down after this election. They're going to take another swing at it. But the only other thing that they can really do, and this is where David Pepper comes back into it, is he is trying really hard to persuade the sort of the cognoscenti in American politics, particularly in Democratic politics, to put money into local races and challenge the other party, even if you're going to lose, so that at least voters get to hear some kind of argument and you don't just abandon half the country to extremists.
Now, you've concentrated on the state of Ohio. How indicative is the experience in Ohio to the rest of the country?
I think that the gerrymandering is all over the country, particularly in states that were important to the Republicans in 2010. So what's interesting, the reason to look at Ohio is there's a bigger gap in some ways between what the general population thinks and the way the legislature is passing bills. But you see this in Wisconsin, you see it in Pennsylvania, and then, you know, certainly down in the South.
The last question you asked David Pepper was if democracy was dead in Ohio. And he said it was on life support. How would you answer that question for yourself, both in Ohio and beyond?
I think life support is the perfect way. I mean, you know, it's got a pulse, but it's getting weaker.
Jane, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
The New Yorker's Jane Mayer. You can find her reporting on Ohio and much more at newyorker.com. We heard earlier from David Pepper, an Ohio politician who is the author of Laboratories of Autocracy. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's August, and if you haven't been away yet this summer, you're probably thinking about getting out of town now. Maybe to a beach, a lake, a water park, somewhere, anywhere. And one of our contributors, Alex Kotlowitz, has been returning to the same stretch of woods, summer after summer, for something like 40 years. If you know Alex Kotlowitz's work, that may come as a surprise. He is a really important chronicler of urban life and poverty in the city of Chicago. His books include An American Summer, There Are No Children Here, and Never a City So Real, all of them set in Chicago. So when I think of Alex, I don't imagine him paddling a canoe, but in fact, at a young age, he found himself on a lake deep in the woods of the northern Midwest, and part of him has never left. Here's Alex.
I was 19 and had taken a break from college. I'd been working as a community organizer in Atlanta, and I was unsure what lay ahead. A friend living in Minnesota suggested that he and I head north, and so we traveled 300 miles from Minneapolis to this remote road called the Gunflint Trail. Near the end of the road, within reach of the Canadian border, we rented a canoe and followed a snaking river into a series of lakes, each more beautiful than the last. My anxieties peeled away. I had never experienced such stillness. This is the Boundary Waters, a wilderness area bigger than the state of Rhode Island, home to over 1,000 lakes, each connected by rocky paths, or portages as they're called, ranging from 80 feet to several miles. It feels mythical here, so pristine that you can drink directly from the lakes. The only way in is by canoe, and once you're in, if you don't have a map, forget about it. You're a goner. Lost in this jigsaw puzzle of lakes, some so small you can swim across them, a few so large they could swallow Manhattan. From that first trip nearly 40 years ago, I was smitten. There's a line that I think about a lot from the conservationist and author Terry Tempest Williams. She writes, "If you know wilderness in the way you know love, you would be unwilling to let it go." I'm 67 now, and I know that these voyages will only get tougher and eventually impossible, and so I'm trying to get up here as much as I can.
So where is that chest, Alex?
Well, I'm gonna put it together.
Okay.
In late June, three friends and I arrived at a bunkhouse we rented from an outfitter. It was our jumping-off point for our trip. We woke early to get our permit and to load six portage packs with clothes, gear, and enough food for 9 days.
Yeah, this one's really heavy, yeah.
Chris, whom I've been paddling with for 3 decades, woke up with a sore throat and was feeling sluggish.
I can bring down a mood pretty easy.
Well, I mean, if you have COVID, man.
We assumed it was COVID.
This is going to be really interesting.
Then my wife Maria called. She'd tested positive.
It's like a funeral this morning. We haven't even started. I'm like, come on, man. All right. I mean, it's all.
We hesitated for just a moment. We figured if Chris has COVID or if I get COVID, what the hell? There couldn't be a more curative place to be than on the water. But then the outfitter, Andy, warned us it wasn't going to be an easy paddle.
seagull.
Yeah, I know. The wind just looks like
the wind is going to be straight into your face.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Yeah, it's a southwest wind. You guys are going southwest, so.
Can you do anything about it?
It's the next few days are going to be a little trying.
You know, it's like we're in the Bermuda Triangle here. We just freaking got here. I've waited 3 years to get here.
That's my friend Gary. He's a longtime backpacker, but this is his first time in the Boundary Waters.
What?
You feeling okay?
Yeah, no. You just got to show me what to do, man. We're good. We're good to go, man.
Our destination that first night was Ogishkamuntsi Lake, which paddlers simply call Ogish. We paddled all day through three lakes into a fierce headwind.
Just straight.
And so didn't get to Ogish until early evening. All 11 campsites were taken.
Yeah, it's a good wind, huh?
This is the wondrous paradox of the Boundary Waters. Even though the campsites on Ogish were full, the lake felt devoid of people. And that's the thing. This is a really popular place to come to in the Midwest. But after a day or two of paddling, you might not see another person for days. After nearly 10 hours of travel on that first day, we pushed on to the next lake, found a campsite, cooked some brats and green beans.
Red wine? Yeah, whatever there is. But yeah, I prefer red.
And then prepared to bed down for the night.
Just be ready, it's going to get dark in half an hour or so.
I came here with my recorder, hoping to capture what so envelops me here. The mournful wails of loons at night. The lakes telling stories. The skies shouting. But it occurred to me that very first night that I can't really capture on tape the true splendor of this place. It inhabits me. It lives inside me. And besides, how can you capture the signature of the Boundary Waters, its quietude? One writer, Sigurd Olsen, described being here as a time for silence.
There's no way that rope is going to hold.
Come on, Alex, don't be a gloomy Gus.
Every night before going to bed, we hang our food to keep it from the bears.
Yeah. We'll make it harder for the bear.
Yeah, that'll be the last, that's the last obstacle for
He's going to say, oh my God, it's tied in knots, forget it. Screw it.
That's Gary again.
It ain't worth it, I'll go to the other campsite.
He can't help himself, he's just naturally exuberant.
Oh my God, we're totally screwing this, you know that.
We once were talking on a Chicago street corner in the early morning. And a man approached us. He scolded Gary. You know you're talking really loud. As if Gary didn't know. It's who he is.
He just pulls on it and comes down.
It's one of the things I love about him. Nine days we paddled and portaged, fished and swam. But we mostly watched and listened.
God, what a beautiful morning, huh? Just, I mean, clear sky.
Fantastic. Yeah, the only thing you hear is the river.
We watched a young eagle feast on a moose carcass in the shallows of a lake. We fended off an aggressive grouse. We ogled the peculiar abundance of butterflies. On past trips, I've spotted moose and mink and otter. One time, Chris and I heard a pack of wolves howling from across a lake. I've canoed past a snapping turtle the size of a car tire. Another time, past a pair of trumpeter swans swimming protectively alongside their two cygnets.
Leaky tent and just filled with mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm. That's why we're out here. This is the fun. Mm.
Needless to say, it's not all serenity here.
You get them all?
No. A shitload of them.
Plus, the portages can be punishing. Carrying the canoe or a 50-pound pack over boulders and through mud, often up steep inclines. Or paddling on a day when the windswept waters turn moody. The swells can get so high that if you're in the bow of the canoe, you can't reach the water with your paddle. Some days, even preparing wood for a fire is tough. The physical exertion, especially at our age, is wearing, but it's as if you're folded into the land. And honestly, it's nothing a few Advil and a good meal won't take care of.
I bet that trout is done.
It is. Yeah.
We ate well on this trip. Yeah. Over four nights, we ate fresh lake trout and northern pike.
It was amazing.
I'm not gonna lie, I like the northern better.
We also had spaghetti and pesto, even jambalaya. Jim, who's an old college friend, and Chris are incredible cooks.
Chris, don't you think that's too much red pepper flakes in there? Causing trouble.
Some travel the boundary waters solo, but I already live too much in my head, and days alone here, I fear, would only pull me further inward. And besides, I relish the company.
The one who should feel humiliated is Chris. He hasn't caught a fish yet. So, Jim, how did that snag feel? Well, when did you figure out that it was a snag and not a huge fish?
Oh, my God. Jim, don't let him do this to you. In the evenings, Chris made us gin and tonics. He uses flavored fizz tablets mixed in lake water.
Wow, look at that sunset over there, guys.
Oh, incredible.
Look at the red up on the corner there. See how it just kind of pokes through the clouds?
Yeah, just amazing. It's like the clouds are so close up here, you feel like you can touch them. Incredible.
Around the campfire, we talk about family, about politics, about books, but most often about really nothing at all.
Where do loons go in the winter?
That's a Wikipedia. We got to wiki that when we get cell service.
I've neglected to mention there's no cell service inside this million acres of lakes and woods. And so we're off the grid, a rare time when we're disconnected from the world.
Woohoo!
Our last night, on a campsite with a panoramic view of Tuscarora Lake, we take our last swim.
Oh my God. So sweet, so cold, it's freezing.
There was quite recently an effort to build a mine, a copper mine, along a river running into this wilderness, a river that feeds these lakes. Mining copper can be particularly toxic, and should any of the toxins leak, it would irreparably contaminate the waters. Who, I ask, would want to risk scarring this place?
Right. I like what Gary said about this place, Chris. He wishes he could bring some of it back with him inside him.
How's that for being deep? It's true.
That's deep. It is true.
It's true, man. Don't you wish, Chris, you could take this home?
All right, we're going to put out the fire.
Okay.
Christopher?
No, I think you.
Me?
Yeah, the newbie.
The newbie, the rookie. Noob.
The MVP.
MVP. What?
Okay, rookie of the year.
Rookie of the year. I'm the only rookie here, so I got to be rookie of the year.
The next day, after three more lakes and two portages, one a mile long, and paddling yet again into a strong headwind, we arrive back where we started. It's habit for me that the first thing I do is call my wife, Maria, to make sure all's well. And this time, I especially wanted to know that she had made it through her bout of COVID okay. She usually preempts me and says, everything's good here. This time, she blurts out, things are really bad. She wasn't talking about her COVID. In the time we'd been gone, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. They expanded the rights to carry a gun. They constrained the EPA. Nothing good. And that first weekend home in my city, Chicago, 10 people were killed, another 62 wounded by gunfire. And just north of the city, a young man with a semi-automatic rifle killed 7 people at a July 4th parade. The country felt like it was shattering. I usually put my paddle away in the garage, but this time I've leaned it against a wall in my office. It's something to hold on to help me slip into that place where I can watch the sky sashay and where I can listen to the lakes breathe. That place where no matter the storms on the horizon, I can find refuge in the stillness. I'm unwilling to let it go.
Alex Kotlowitz. His most recent book is An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Alex would like to thank Tuscarora Lodge and Canoe Outfitters and Chris Walker, Jim Adler, and Gary Marks, who allowed Alex to record their vacation.
They told me specifically to get people washing dishes.
You want to trade places, Alex?
That's my point. No, you don't know how to handle a microphone.
It looks really hard.
You just wash the dishes and leave the artist alone, okay?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Susan Orlean has been writing for The New Yorker for many years. Recently, she started a new column, and it's called Afterword. It's an obituary column, but the lives that Susan is writing about aren't the usual prominent people. She wrote recently about a tavern owner in Portland, Oregon, the inventor of a popular suntan lotion, and a restaurateur in Los Angeles's Chinatown. But recently, Susan wrote about one life you almost certainly knew of, a very well-known person with an even more famous name.
Ivana Trump always had the highest hair in the room. In her younger years, her frothy blonde mane was bobbed, and her forelock and the hair on her crown were teased a lofty 3 inches off her scalp. The result was sculptural, dimensional. In later years, she transitioned to a beehive, a solid-looking mound on the top of her head, finished off with wispy bangs. The website, thehairstyler.com, calls it, quote, the Ivana Trump long straight updo, and rates its popularity at just a half star out of the possible 5. But Ivana, always the boss of her, went her own way. Celie Salon on the Upper East Side of Manhattan produced her hairdo for the past 2 decades.
Her hair always has to be perfect. Every day we trim the hair bangs, make sure it's a finished perfect look.
The salon's website features several pictures of Ivana modeling her look. The rest of the photos show women with more contemporary hair, long and loose and without elevation. But Ivana stayed the course. It was always 1963 on her head.
Even in the pandemic time, she always wanted to look, you know, nice, hair done, taking care of her look. She's an iconic woman in New York City.
In one of the last photos taken of her in public, she was on her way to the salon. What's surprising about the picture is that her hair is in a low ponytail, flat against her head. It's probably no accident that the caption points out that she had let her hair down, something she rarely did in public, likely in anticipation of people not believing that it was her. When we first came to know Ivana in the 1980s, she was married to her second husband, Donald, who was then merely a loudmouth, russet-faced developer, without the slightest whiff of the presidential rising from him. At the time, they seemed a perfect pair. She was fabulous. He was a fabulist. He inflated his net worth in her modeling and skiing accomplishments. He bought revered landmarks such as the Plaza Hotel in New York. She gilded and bedazzled them. She had crazy hair. He had crazy hair. His quiff became as much his signature as the beehive became hers. Ultimately, of course, the scale of and the damage done by her excesses was nothing compared with his. She called him the Donald. The addition of the article to his name made it seem like a royal title or an honorific. But she never undersold herself. In fact, she was confident of her value. To that end, she applied to trademark her name in 1989 in case she wanted to monetize her brand. It turned out to be a wise move because she ended up selling a lot of Ivana Trump products on TV shopping channels.
This is a great look here.
They're absolutely fantastic. They are cool. They are, you know, really hot, hot, hot.
Still, Donald Trump occupied a lot of psychological, social, and emotional real estate. How would it feel to be yoked to that? One Trump wife didn't seem to dig it. I was once sent on an assignment to Mar-a-Lago, Trump's toehold in Palm Beach, and dragged myself to a morning yoga class there. Marla Maples, who by then had replaced Ivana as Mrs. Trump, was in the class, downward dogging next to me. And afterward, in the locker room, we got to chatting. She seemed tired, not from the yoga, but perhaps from the sheer weightiness of being part of the Trump apparatus. They divorced not long afterward. Ivana, by contrast, always displayed a peppery energy and a genuine relish for her role as a Trump. She seemed animated by the attention, even when it was negative. It all was a compliment, by her reckoning. She once told Vanity Fair, quote, "I think it's upsetting to people that Donald and I have it all." After their divorce and respective remarriages, she kept the name and proudly announced to interviewers, "I am the first Trump wife," as if she were part of a pre-planned production rollout where the first model is viewed as the most authentic, the best.
How often do you two talk?
Talk about once in 14 days. I have the direct number to White House, but I don't really want to call him there because Melania is there, and I don't want to cause any kind of jealousy or something like that because I'm basically first Trump wife, okay? I'm first lady, okay?
We will never know the truth behind one of Ivana's last big public gestures in 2017, when she claimed that the Donald had offered her a role as ambassador to the Czech Republic, where she was born, the daughter of an electrical engineer and a telephone operator. In a wonderful flourish, perhaps the ultimate cold shoulder to the husband who had cheated on her, she claimed that she had turned down the job. Did he really offer her the ambassadorship? Who knows? But it was a brilliant move on her part to suggest that while he might think he was all that, she really couldn't be bothered. As she explained triumphantly in an interview with CBS Sunday Morning, "I have a perfect life.
Why would I go and say bye-bye to Miami in the winter, bye-bye to Saint-Tropez in the summer, and bye-bye to spring and fall in New York? I have a perfect life."
Ivana Trump died in July. You can read Susan Orlean's column afterward at newyorker.com. And we also heard in that piece from Trump's longtime hairstylist, Sally Kukierka. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofeni Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.